Yeah, let's give a big Third Coast welcome to Jorge Jess.
Thank you. Great. So, that was the introduction. I've been working on a show called Heavyweight. I did not put the slide up yesterday, but I'm very proud of the work that we've been doing, so try it out, please. If you send tweets to J_Goldstein, please use the hashtag blessed. All right, as we've established, my name is Jorge Just. And this is a panel on editing. And one of the questions that gets asked the most, or that I hear a lot, is how do I become an editor? And so since my path is fairly typical, I figured that I'd start up just by telling you how I got here. And it's been a long road. Since I was, 6 or 7 years old, I knew that I wanted to be an editor. I dressed as an editor every year for Halloween. Well, my friends were all begging their parents to take them to the theater to see Jaws for the 15th time. I was begging mine to send me to summer editing camp. And yes, I know the Jaws reference is really dating myself, but it was it was a phenomenon. It was really the best, the first of the summer blockbusters. And you should read, it was crazy, you should read up on it. Anyway, by the time I got to high school, I was pretty much eating, breathing, sleeping, editing. And even still, it turned out that my school had a pretty good editing team, so I didn't even make varsity until senior year. But it so happens that was the year we went to state championships. So I ended up at Trinity College. That's the one in Dublin, not the one in Connecticut. And then I went to get my doctorate in editing at University of Cambridge. And from there, it's basically just been one job after another, 5 years here, 10 years there, just doing the thing that I love. So that's how me and how I got here. But we're really only 1 or 2%, no more than probably 5% of editors follow a traditional path like that. Most of them bounce around doing other stuff, freelance writing, radio, working with bands, doing humanitarian work for a couple years, location-based audio, just typical stuff. And the reason for that is because, unlike, say, hedge fund manager, editor is in a fixed job description with strict job requirements, which is to say, there's no one way to be a good editor. And most editors become editors by learning on the job, which isn't, it's not what you want out of your surgeon. But that is what you get out of your editor, often. So either they learn after becoming editors themselves or just over the years working with really great people. So becoming a good editor is mostly about doing it and about recognizing your mistakes and learning from them. And that, for the most part, is what this presentation is about. Any editor will tell you that a good story needs an arc and a beginning and a middle and an end. That is not true of presentations. This one has a beginning, and now it's just going to go, and it's going to bounce around, and you'll edit it together in your head and give it your own narrative. So I'm going to talk to you about the things I've learned to do and not do, the mistakes I've made, and about strengths and weaknesses. Each editor has their strengths and weaknesses, and there's no comprehensive primer on editing, so I'm not even going to try. I will give you a few suggestions. While you're here, while you're still here, there are great editors amongst you. Go and ask them questions and talk to them. Ask them like the hard, weird, personal questions that you have with either the producers you work with or the editors that you work with, because they won't have any stake in it. I also very much encourage you to listen to Deborah George's Third Coast session from 2008. It's really great, especially for the descriptions of what the actual work is, for her tricks on getting producers to make good work, her, you know, the imagine the scenarios she asked them to imagine, et cetera, and just a bunch of other good stuff. I also encourage you to read Julia Barton's Transom pieces on editing, and really basically anything that she has written that you can find on editing. And to find and get advice from Peter Clowney, who is here today, and whose thoughts I have plagiarized for this session. So yes, do those things, please. Don't do them during the session, because that's offensive. So basically, the most important thing that an editor does is try to make the work better. And the basic way that you do that is by trying to be an extra couple of folds on your producer's brain. More specifically, a few of the things. I like to help shape pitches, stories, ideas, themes, structure, production logistics. Sometimes listening to tape and looking through transcripts, editing drafts, obviously, listening through, giving notes, making changes, gradually refining, copy editing, fine editing. And most important, while you're doing that, trying to also be teaching or at least explaining yourself along the way, right? When I said the most important thing was to make the work better, it's also to make the people that you're working with better, right? It's so that they can become editors, edit their own work, and you can retire to St. Bart's. Let's see. So one of the most important things that you have to be able to do as an editor is the ability to sort of future listen, right? Which is to listen to something that's in a rough state and actually hear what it could be, what it has the potential to end up being. This is a learned skill, or at the very least, it is an acquired one. And it's acquired by listening to a lot of stuff and listening to a lot of stuff that is in rough states. And it's refined by practice. If you aren't able to do this, it's going to be a problem. Because I won't get into the details, but I worked at a company called Detour, and for very, very, very good reasons, we would do our early drafts in something that radio people hate. Let's see if I can figure this out. It's the robot voice.
Up at the dome. It's peaceful here. It's tranquility. There is something about sleeping in a church that adds a sort of serenity to the whole deal. I slept in a
We're doing hour-long pieces.
I would rather be on the street and come.
Now, it takes a very good editor with lots of foresight to be able to judge that story on its merits. And to imagine that someday it might turn out like this.
Move around the pews and walk down the center aisle. Now you can slip into a pew in the front section or stop near the altar. Look up at the dome. It's peaceful here. It's tranquility. There is something about sleeping in a church that adds a sort of serenity to the whole deal. I slept in a shelter once, got robbed. I would rather be on the street than coming to the Gubbio Project. It's a different atmosphere. Look up at the blue dome painted high above the altar. And do you see the friar spreading his arms under the Holy Trinity? Well, that's St. Francis. Now, God challenged St. Francis to give up everything he owned and rebuild the church with his own hands. I think about that story every time I'm in St. Boniface, because the homeless you see here, like St. Francis, are rebuilding their lives from nothing.
So that's the most, thank you, I should say that while you're listening to that, you are actually in this place, and so it's very enveloping and affecting. That's the most extreme example that I can think of future listening. Sure. Sure. It's from the company's called Detour, and it's a walking tour of the Tenderloin in San Francisco. Yes.
I didn't
understand
what
the tour was saying. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to keep doing this. You did not understand why we did it or what it had to do with.
That was how you're doing edits?
Mm-hmm. Right. So, for those projects, they're these hour-long documentaries, basically, but they're GPS-enabled walking tours. So as you go, the audio, the music, ambience, sound effects are all triggered by GPS as you walk through a space. So if you were to do every, and that adds a layer of complexity to audio stories that. It is very extreme. And so to refine, you would have to go travel back to this neighborhood every time to see if it, you know, how it felt, how it walked through, down the block, et cetera. And so to save time, we would create these robo voices, hour-long sessions with different voices for different narrators and all of this stuff. And so you had to be able to have to think forward through all of that time and space and energy to get from robo voice to something like that. So making the worker better, teaching. As an editor, especially when working with less experienced producers, primary goal is to listen carefully, but not just to the piece, right? You also need to be listening to the process and the challenges behind getting the work where it is, the constraints that are keeping it from going to where it needs to be. And so I think of this, or be understanding. That means good bedside manner. Know and remember that the work is very hard to do, and the person across from you has put a ton of effort into whatever they're presenting to you, actively trying to make things possible. Also remember, I think Jad uses the term the German forest. Ben Calhoun calls it the pit of despair. You are going to be getting stuff from people who are deep in the middle of the pit of despair, lost in the German forest, and you can't necessarily be the path out of it, but your job is to try to provide a map, to try to help people get through that to the other side. Be understanding also means, like, try to be understanding, as in actively try to understand what's being played for you. Don't be a lazy listener. Try to figure out what the producer's trying to do, even when it's a total mess. This is not everybody's philosophy. There is a philosophy that you should approach these things as a naive listener, as a dumb listener, so that you don't gloss over missing details or subconsciously fill in details. I don't like that philosophy because I think you're guaranteed to get it wrong most of the time. You're either going to skew to being not dumb enough or too dumb, and out of the two, there's more danger in being, you know, pretending to be too dumb of a listener, too naive of a listener, because you'll start ironing out the piece and filling in details that don't need to be filled in. And so I have two solutions for that naive listener problem. One is just don't let it happen. Just, like, be very aware and listen as yourself. And two is to find somebody, if you need, who listens differently than you do. I worked with somebody who wasn't an editor, but had a pretty good editorial mind and had one of the worst attention spans of anybody I've ever met. And I have a terrible attention span, and so I know of what I speak. And so sometimes I'd play him stuff, and he would, you know, halfway through, start checking his phone, get up, walk around the room, and that was fine, because that's what I wanted him there for. I could see him do that, and all I had to do was, like, take notes and find my trouble spots, because that's where he was getting lost or getting bored or just abandoning it. know your audience. You're going to notice a theme through this presentation of me saying similar things in different ways, because I think they're very important. So by know your audience, I mean be super mindful about what level the person that you're working with is at. That way that the way that you help someone who is just starting out is very, very different from the way you help someone who's been working on this stuff for their entire career. At Gimlet, like I said, I've been working on Heavyweight, which is hosted by Jonathan Goldstein, and senior producer is Wendy Doerr, who between them, and I asked them, so I can confirm, they have over 250 years of radio experience just between the two of them. I'm also working on a show called Twice Removed, which comes out in December, and some for some of the producers on that show, this is their very first job in radio. So I regularly jump from edits with someone who's hosted his own show for 11 years into an edit with somebody who was in a completely different field 8 months ago. And that requires you as an editor to have more than one approach. So somebody at some point, I don't know who, and I don't know when, took a management course, poor bastard. And one of the handouts in that management course was this. And this is a way of classifying people, which is what we should all strive to do. But it's basically, this is jargon and management jargon, but it's very, very, very useful for thinking, don't think of it as worker bees, think of it as producers and reporters and the people that you're working with. So there's four boxes: enthusiastic beginner, disillusioned learner, capable, cautious performer, self-reliant achiever. Enthusiastic beginner, somebody who's really new to the gig, has a ton to learn, really eager to learn about it and to learn from you. Disillusioned learner, someone who's been at it for a little while, months, a year, you know, a year. In some jobs, in some places, many years. That's, you know, they're making mistakes, sometimes feel like they're never gonna get it, are discouraged. The capable, cautious performer, they've gotten out of that deep trough of sorrow, pretty good at their job and self-confident, but still tentative, self-critical. And then the last box, which is the expert, the people that are doing the radio doctor classes and the pitch sessions down the hall. And then this is the sort of analog. This is a guide for how to approach people at each stage in sort of their experience. So with the beginner, be a teacher first and be direct. Don't be afraid to tell them what to do as long as you're explaining why. Help them understand how long something should take. Help them map out the process. They don't know, and they want to know, and they want to learn. This is where you take the keyboard, where you make the cuts yourself with them sitting next to you. Disillusioned learner, right? That's that person who's been at it, has gotten to a certain point, and then is coming up against the wall. And this is sort of think of this as coaching. So you're also teaching, but it's a little bit less hands-on. It's more that like Socratic teaching that your best professors were really good at. Getting you to come up with the thought and make the connections. By you, I mean the producer. And you as the editor are still hands-on, but you're mostly, you know, making sure they're moving in the right direction. Capable, cautious performer is starting to push the person out of the nest. You're doing more listening, helping shape their ideas, acting as a sounding board, but still sort of giving them the guidance. And then finally, there's the person who's been doing it forever. In this case, you're just supporting them. You're a resource. And hopefully, you know, treating them as a collaborator and as a peer. Does that make sense as a construct? That's helpful to think about in, particularly in like early parts of the editing process, like when you're shaping stories and working with producers and thinking about structure and themes and all that. But I think it can be applied in lots of different ways as well. And so I'm going to give you examples from how I do that, how I use, when we're doing like sort of copy editing or editing drafts, how I apply those thoughts. And I think the examples are all from Google Docs, which we use a lot. So like I said, when somebody's in that first box, rewriting, taking the keyboard, directly making changes to the script, to the session, being directive, but also showing what you're doing, showing them why, you know, letting them try things out, but doing it yourself. Strike through and bold. So I'm just going to turn and look. I use this a lot with people who are in that second box, right? Where I want them to be able to make changes, but I also want them to have to do the work to make the changes. So I'll strike through cuts, I'll put things in bold that I, you know, I'll rewrite things and put them in bold. And so I'm still working with them, or, you know, doing a lot of the work of the edit, but letting them be a part of it. In some psychological way. Suggest mode, track changes. That is exactly the same thing. It's just using a totally different tool. And this takes, it gives them the authority, right? There's like a little X, and if they hit X, then the thing that I changed goes away. If they hit check mark, then it happens. They can see like the changes, they can see the way that I'm thinking through something, but they can reject it. And that's, I think, for people in that third box. There's also crazy writing. This was a producer came into a session and really needed a transition. She wanted a transition between these two thoughts, and we talked about it, and then I wrote out this sentence, and I wrote it, and I habitually write it and misspell everything, put it in all caps, and that's because I want her to know that this is the idea that we're working on, and I am putting it out there, but not with any authority. Like, in order for this to make it into the script, to be a part of the story, she has to take it and turn it into writing. Perhaps a better example is this. Which is like a whole scene that needed to happen. And so we talked it through, and I wrote all of this stuff up. As you can see, it's gonna be an amazing scene. But there's like no way that this can end up in a script, right? This is, if this person were in box one, we would have talked about it, and we would have written it up, and that person would have left the edit with this thing finished. This is once somebody has gotten to that point, you want them to be able to, you want the edit to be sharing ideas, getting to a place, and then sending them off into the world to make it happen. And then comments. This is for like people in box three and box four. This is just, here's what we talked about, or here's my idea, you go and make it. This is the exact same thing as this. It's just that for some people in their careers, it's a lot, this is going to be anxiety inducing. And for people further in their careers, this is going to be insulting. So it's just tailoring your strategies to where people are. And then this is like a page from a heavyweight script. And I think pink is Jonathan Goldstein and green is me, and we're just sitting across from each other and just writing together and changing each other's sentences and going, because there's confidence on both people's parts. We know we're a team. We know, have the sense of where things are going, and that's all we have to do is execute. This is what I call McCuning. Just, I like this. This is how Marianne McCune edits stuff, and I think that Somebody told me that it's very similar to KQED and other NPR stations. But I think she, Marianne McCune is a genius, by the way. So, and she also has a great Third Coast that you should listen to. But what she does is she puts things directly into the script, and she mixes sort of all of those strategies. So all caps and in bold, that is sentences she's written that she's added. Square, three square brackets over there, that's a cut. In parentheses, which all caps, that is, I want you to fill in this information however you're going to. This one is, I believe, pointing out a sentence, and then in all caps, this is her saying, you've got to fix this sentence to do this thing, right? This is like crazy making to me, but incredibly useful to the people that she works closely with, because again, it's just really pouring through the script and figuring out when you have to be directive and when people can do, you know, when you can let people be themselves. All right, how are we doing? Does that stuff make sense so far? All right. Then let us continue. Some general rules. Trust your producers. So unless they tell you otherwise, believe that the people that you're working with actually have a story and an idea, a thing that they are trying to say. Sometimes it's hard to find in the work. But more than once, I've seen an editor come into a piece and just start moving stuff around, rewriting without understanding what the producer is trying to do. And that's, to be fair, that's usually the producer or the reporter's fault. It isn't clear. But if the producer doesn't know that their idea isn't coming through, then and they see an editor just start moving stuff around herky-jerky and destroying their piece, that can be very destructive to them. That is a really shitty day. So if something seems arbitrary, if you get this thing and it just seems like a jumbled mess, you have to remember to ask, which means sometimes you have to interview your own producers. Get them to say the thing that you need to hear, right? Practice your good interviewing techniques. You might have to ask them a bunch of different ways to get at it. Ask them to tell you the story. Ask them why it's important. Ask them to read, to go through the beats of it, diagram it. Ask them what the most interesting like nugget or their favorite moment, so that you can start figuring out what the piece is actually about. That being said, also try not to give them obvious suggestions. These are just like general rules of being a good person, probably, but within an edit, they are very helpful. So asking like super obvious general questions about where a piece is another way of killing confidence. So instead of asking why, if they scheduled time with Johanna for their historical documentary about the Third Coast Festival, which obviously they would have thought of, ask them what they're working, like what leads they're thinking of pursuing, what voices they're thinking that you need to tell that story. Let them take the lead so that your suggestions come off as additive and not diminishing. I see this rule get broken all the time, and I think that the reason is, and I break it as well, and I think the reason is that editors often become kind of a co-producer on these pieces, and you want to help and you want to get into the work, and that can be very helpful to producers, but at times it can also be burdensome. This is an example of those times. So trust your producers. Also, don't trust your producers. This is a hydration break. So everybody gets too close to their work. Everybody loses sight of what they have, where they're trying to get to, what's standing in the way. People especially lose track of decisions they've made along the way as a piece goes from edit to edit to edit to edit to edit to edit. So don't be afraid to ask them to share everything with you. One tip that I often do is like ask them to play, like if we're listening to tape or almost at any time in the process, ask to hear the pieces of tape that almost made the cut. Things that are just sort of hidden in, you know, the last things that they didn't use. Things that were rejected along the way. Ask to see their transcripts and quickly scan through them. And if you see something that seems useful, ask them why they didn't use it and ask them to play it for you so you can talk about it. Ask to hear the tape on either side of important moments that they've chosen in their piece. This can be shockingly helpful because producers will try something, they'll cut something together, and it'll sort of work, and then they'll move on. And so, you know, a week later, they won't remember what they did. This happened like last week with the upcoming episode of Heavyweight. Let's see if this works. So the next episode of Heavyweight is Jonathan is it's a very personal episode. He's trying to figure out sort of why he moved away from religion, and he goes and asks his childhood rabbi, for whom he has a lot of respect, to try and.
You're still a year shy of going anyway. How old were you when Tisha that you were calling me? 15.
16.
You're trying to understand what happened.
A little bit.
I do recall your parents were not supportive.
Okay, so did we get what the heart of that piece of tape was? I'll play it one more time. Oh.
You were still a year shy of going anyway. How old were you when Tisha that you were calling me?
15. 16.
You're trying to understand what happened.
A little bit.
I do recall your parents were not supportive.
Okay, so it turns out that the big moment in this story, as it was created, and this was close to, you know, final draft, was coming out of a moment of small talk, and it's totally buried, and we couldn't figure out how to enhance it until we noticed that there was a cut, and I asked Jonathan to pull out the tape around it, and this is what was there.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know if
you're
it's...
You're trying to understand what happened.
A little bit.
Right, like, actually, Jonathan was doing this very, very, very difficult thing and having trouble with it, and that was captured on tape. And somewhere along the way, people with 250 years of radio experience had lost track of that, building a scene and doing, you know, everything else, getting information that they thought they needed to. But so once you see that, then it can change everything, and the entire, you know, section of the show got rewritten and became more emotional, but also more honest.
But otherwise, he looks the way I remember him from all those decades ago. We catch up. He tells me about his children and his children's children, and I tell him about my marriage to a Gentile. And even after all these years, I still feel myself fearing his disappointment. I struggle to ask the question I came here to ask. I don't know if
it's... You're trying to understand what happened.
A little bit.
I do recall your parents were not supportive.
Right, it changes everything. That, I should note, is a rough mix. When it comes out on Tuesday, it might be disco or something. I have no idea. So there's that. Another general rule is to trust yourself, even if it means being terribly, terribly mean. You have to have a strong enough backbone to know when something's not working. And no matter how late in the process you are, you've got to push to make the change. This is another story about the great Marianne McCune. She once took basically 16 months off of my life because I asked her to listen to this thing I was working on. It was a Detour, an hour-long piece. It was like I was asking for fine edits. We were getting ready to launch, to publish it. And her fine edit was that the narration and the narrator himself was not only not working, that he was completely irredeemable. That is not a fine edit that you want to get on something that you've been working on for months. And And that's how blinded I had become to the problems. I was listening to it, working with other people, and wanted it to work so well that I wasn't allowing my inner editor to say, fuck, you have to do this. You have to make this change. And she was right. I'm not going to play you those clips because it's horribly embarrassing. But thanks to Marianne, I'll probably die after this session if I was going to die 16 months from now. But if you have to be mean, you have to be mean. Sometimes making work good requires it. All right, so actual edits. This is Peter Clowney's four-step process for editing. Listen attentively. Take note of what's happening to you while you're listening. Say back to the person what you heard, what it was like for you. Give feedback. He says give feedback not so much about what's good and bad, but what he got excited about. I think that depending on where you are in the process, you can give feedback about what's good and bad. But he's talking about the very top. And give a couple of sweeping statements at the top. What's strong? What gives you joy first? What was the experience of listening? And then step three is to just like dive into the questions. Things that I wondered about, things I didn't understand, questions that are sort of driven by confusion, but also in trying to get answers to those, asking about the reporter's sort of experience of creating the piece of listening it. And then taking notes on the language that the reporter uses and writing it that down, taking notes so that you can then reapply it in the writing. And then four is coming to answers down here. She says if you do the first three well, then this part can just be tilling the soil. It's not here's what you need to do, but here are possibilities, while keeping attention to like what's triggering the producer, who knows the piece as well as anybody. He also came up to me before the session and said that actually number four, the most important thing about number four is having a vocabulary. To actually know what works and what doesn't work, and to be able to talk about it and explain it, and that the way to get to that point is to listen constantly, to listen to things all the time and steal what you need to, so that you can help guide people. And then making sure that there's clarity on what comes next, what was decided, like where the piece is going, so people have a roadmap. Very briefly, people will tell you over and over that experiencing a piece the way it's going to be consumed is really important, meaning that if it's audio, then you should listen to it. At Detour, where we were making these walking tours, that meant doing walking edits. So the editor would go out into the neighborhood, producer would call them on the phone and read the script and play tape while you were walking around. Because that's the way you consume Detours. And they were by far some of the most informative and productive edits I've ever been a part of. They were also the only edits that I've ever done in the rain. And the same is true for regular linear news and documentary audio. Listen to the thing. I like to listen with just the producer at first, and then as you go through more edits to bring in other people who haven't heard the piece. But keeping in mind that once you do that, then your role as editor changes. You are less an editor and more of a moderator, and you have to make sure that you're controlling group feedback so that it stays useful and doesn't go off the rails. So when you're thinking about bringing other people in, that is a thing to very much keep in mind. Your status changes, so the piece should be in a place where that's okay. And another important note, be really thoughtful about when you're bringing new people in to listen, be thoughtful about the kind of feedback that they can give. So if you're looking for high-level feedback, you bring in somebody with experience. If you're looking for feedback of, this made me feel X, or this made me feel Y, or I was bored here, or I didn't understand, then you can bring in somebody with the person from marketing or your friend from apothecary school. But bringing that person in to an edit where you really need sort of high-level feedback is going to be not helpful to them, not helpful to the process, and not helpful to the producer. Group edits. Group edits are great. Say it with me. I'm going to request that we cut that response from the people who are great at them are really great, and they should, and that's the thing. Not everybody is great at them. They can be really difficult, but they can save a lot of time. This is not a small point. When you're making a lot of, when you're working with a lot of people and working on a lot of stuff, being able to like listen something through, have a discussion about it, and then go on to the next thing, that's really helpful to both you and the people that you're working with. They bring in more ears and brains to listen to a story, which means more opportunity to hear problems that have been overlooked and to improve the piece, and to avoid, you know, to fill in your blind spots. If you're working with a lot of new producers, having them in the room can give them the opportunity to hear works in progress, let them see the vegan sausage being made. If you've got a group that works well together and is experienced and has a shared vision, then this is like almost absolutely the way to go. That heavyweight clip I played earlier came from a group edit. There was five people there. And we listened to it. We had a lot of feedback. But then we just started working on it together. And that thing that I played, that happened during like a 4-hour, just all of us jamming on this thing together, trying to solve the problems that we'd identified. That's not something you're going to be able to do with every group. Group edits not so great. Say it with me. I can see where the voting is. So what are the problems with group edits? They can become performative exercises, right? People feeling like they need to contribute, people feeling like they need to parrot what other people are saying. They can actually take a whole lot of time, especially if you're only getting it at bigger surface level issues. It's not always easy to get fine-grained, which can make it sort of more difficult to move things forward. You have a bunch of people listen to it, and everybody's like, yeah, it's kind of working or not working, but you don't, it's hard to, it can be very hard to get into the structure of something and really make it better. There can be pressure to build consensus, to work things out in the session rather than just take notes and return to a one-on-one edit, which, depending on the situation, I think can be much more helpful. And the pressure to build consensus means that a couple of things can happen. Either people with sort of different ideas might stay silent, which is counterproductive to like their sense of awesomeness and also the piece becoming awesome. And it can also lead to everything sounding the same. They can feel exclusionary, and they can go off the rails entirely if they aren't carefully calibrated. So this is what I mean when I say having to go from being an editor to being a moderator. I completely horse-fucked an edit about 2 weeks ago. I was with that's an old radio term. I don't know if... but it was a producer, a senior producer, and a producer from a different show. And we listened to this piece, and at the end of the piece, everybody was... like, the response was pretty unanimous. Like, all we need is... this is just needs some like a copy editing, a few sentences here and there, and it is good to go. And then we started doing that, and then one person had an idea, and someone else thought, why not try it? And then big chunks of the thing started to get moved around, and then a couple of central ideas of the piece got basically not just struck through or suggested away, but just deleted off the page. And it was all like very smart, very eager, very experienced people trying to make this thing better. But at a certain point, I looked over at the producer and just saw the panic on her face. And so the last 10 minutes of this edit ended up being me realizing what had happened and then just having to walk us back through all the work that we had just done, ruining this thing that had been pretty good. And then the 10 minutes after the edit was me apologizing to the producer for letting that happen, because that was my responsibility, even if I wasn't driving those changes. I wasn't recognizing that we weren't doing the thing that we had all agreed to do. We were doing something different, and in that, we were losing what was good about the piece. So don't do that. So this is, now we're just going through tips and stuff. Two questions that I like to ask. Yes?
When you say group edit, is that edit with friends, you're here managing that group?
That is, yes. So it, so there's a, yeah, yes. I mean, everybody has their style. I think ideally, yes, there's a person that is leading, and there are people that are, and they're listening along with everybody else, but they're the person who is in charge of, like, getting information from everybody, hearing what people thought, making sure that that the responses are as helpful as possible. So if somebody says something and there's like a kernel there, getting more out of it and getting sort of the group involved. And yeah, that person should have the final thought. Hopefully, if it's going well, then it just becomes clear and everybody is, it's all about creating collaboration. But with that in mind, there's a couple of things that I do that are very, very, very simple that help you get there. And one is to ask like the percentage done question. You should do this. This is also something I stole from the internet, and I don't know from who, but it's really helpful. Not just in edits, but when somebody asks you for feedback on anything, I always ask them like, what percentage done do you think this is? Is it, how long, far along is it? Is it at 30% done, 50% done, 80% done? And the reason why is that this gives you an idea for what kind of feedback they need. So if they tell you something is at 20% done, then you know that you're gonna be talking about structure and about like big things, and you're not gonna be bothered with copy editing and wordsmithing. If something is at 80% done, then you know that that's the big stuff is not what you should be listening for. What they're looking for is refinement, rewriting things to make it clearer and more pronounceable, et cetera. And let's see. That's particularly important for me because I know like what I like to do. I am a tinker. I like to make the perfect cut. I like to make the perfect sentence. And if I start doing that at when somebody is at a needs something completely different, when they need me to say, the idea that is at the center of this piece needs to be expanded on or has to change in some different way, then I'm completely wasting their time. And the opposite is true. So let's see. That makes sense to everybody, yes? Another reason for asking that question is because it gives you a sense for where they think the piece is, and sometimes somebody will tell you that something's at 70% or 80%, and then you'll hear it, and it will not be there at all. And if your first response is to say, when they're expecting you to say, it just needs some copy editing, your first response is, we've got to lose 8 minutes out of this thing. Having that information ahead of time allows you to deliver that news in a way that doesn't, just destroy the producer in the process. The other question is like, what do you want me to focus on? Is there anything you want me to focus on in particular? Anything that you're worried about? In her Third Coast presentation, Deborah George said that she prefers that producers not come to her with like any excuses or caveats or introducing the piece, just play the thing. I think that is good and true, but this is something different. This is asking them to be specific about the things that they're worried about to think and the things that they need help with. Half the time, you're just going to forget that. as soon as you start listening. But that's not the point. The point is to get a sense of where they think they are with it, to see what their blind spots are. Because if they tell you that they're worried about transitions or the ending doesn't hit hard enough, again, and actually the change is really drastic, you'll have that information ahead of time, and you can be thoughtful about how to direct the news. What else do we have? Be mindful of voice. This is your voice, especially, and not falling in love with it, right? Your job is to maintain the voice of producers or reporters, or help them develop one of their own if they haven't yet. It's really easy to fall into the trap of turning everything into sounding like you. And house style absolutely needs to be broken sometimes. Nobody wants to just be stamping out widgets or sprockets every single day. Every now and again, you go ahead and stamp out a wicket or a sprodget. Be honest. Once you hear the piece, it's okay to tell them that it's good. It's okay to use a dumb cliche like, this is in really good shape, but only if it's true. If it's terrible, you can go ahead and tell them what's good about it first, but it doesn't help anybody to not be honest about what is working and what's not working and what needs to happen. This is good for the producer to remembering this is good for the producer. It's also good for you because it'll keep you from falling in love with this weird idea that being nice means that you're coddling, pointing out that what's good about a piece is just wasting time. That's like a dark path to going. That's a dark path for you as an editor, because you will go into edits thinking, I'm going to fix this thing, when what you want to do is to go into edits thinking, I'm going to make this thing better. So there's that. So there's a couple of things that we can do. This is the end of the slide presentation of the show. I can show you how I take notes. I can extemporate, blah, 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 talk a little bit about, more about edits. Notes? All right. This is where I embarrass myself in front of the world. You are the world. Let's see if I have this open. Shout out questions while I do this. That's a statue. This was taken from a rooftop in Buenos Aires. That's just a statue that's going out off of a wall. I'm not sure who the guy is, but I really like the, I really like it. Yes?
It's a little bit of a weird question. Okay. And it's a two-part.
All right. There's no such thing as two-part questions.
The what? Okay. Well, my question is, what are some common mistakes that you see editors, particularly first-time or new editors, make? And the theoretical second part of that question was, as a reporter or producer, what are some kind of defense mechanisms against perhaps bad editing?
What are some mistakes? I mean, I think I tried to list a bunch of mistakes. I mean, I think that they are not listening, like openly not coming at the piece in, coming at it at the stage that it needs to be, not allowing, coming in with too ingrained or too solid a vision of what the structure of this thing is or what this thing should be, and not being open to listening to other ways of doing it. I think those are mistakes an editor makes. I think there's other opposite mistakes an editor makes, which is not being directive enough, not just saying, sometimes you producers and reporters and writers and everybody else are just like terrible and you suck and are garbage and your idea is dumb and I'm gonna make it better. I think it's, I mean, not in those words, but I think people err most frequently on both sides of this. The best thing I think that a reporter can do or a producer can do in any situation where they're feeling like they are not, where they're, if you're coming out confused from an edit, that is bad. And that confusion can come in lots of different ways. It can come in, I don't know what to do next. It can also be, I don't understand, or I was thinking about this in this way, and now this thing has been totally changed. Either way, the best thing that you can do is to like really force yourself to ask the questions, to make the editor explain to you what is happening and why, and to assert like your thoughts about it. Assert like you may have done something that doesn't work, but you, if you did it for a reason that you think is important, explaining that, because the easiest thing for an editor to do is say, this doesn't work, let's make this piece work. It's harder for an editor, especially if he doesn't know, if the editor doesn't know why that's in there, it's harder to say, for the editor to help you figure out how to make the thing work with this in it or with this idea. So that is a thing. Also, yeah, bringing in, if, just like editors can bring in other people, if you are having trouble communicating with your editor, you can also ask to bring in other people. It may help or it might not, but just, you know, a lot of editing is about like communication, a lot of it is about sort of social dynamics, and you are able to affect those as much as or more as the editor. There's nothing, I don't think, terribly groundbreaking in these photos other than that I've created my own written language that nobody else can understand. But so this is a, these are notes from like basically this hour-long piece, an assembly, listening, like basically the first assembly. What I try to do is for sort of every, if I can, for every sentence, but if not for every sort of thought, piece of tape, moment, I try to at least get like one word down. I run a timer and I write down like where we are, you know, whenever I can. It doesn't necessarily have to be related to the thing that I'm listening to. It's just to sort of keep a running time so that I can go back when I'm looking at this and thinking about, you know, where we're going to cut half an hour from this, what's supposed to be a 60-minute thing, I know. And then I'm writing down moments that are sort of like confusing to me, things that, you know, just like broad, like this whole section needs to be cut. It says map tape and in parentheses meh and then a star, meaning that meh is very important. But then the idea was like we have to go straight to this one piece of tape. Maybe move this thing to the top. These are like sort of like big broad things that I'm listening to as I go, but mostly it's just like a mad scramble to get actively listen to, and to put question marks and stars and things where, so I can go back and be like, oh right, I didn't understand this, or this piece of tape wasn't working, or et cetera, et cetera. So that is that. This is basically notes from that same piece, but one. Well, so, yeah, and I'm happy to talk about that. I think, yeah. So I'll go through this, and then I'll really quickly sort of talk about when I edit with a script and when I don't. Okay, great. So this is basically notes from that same that same piece, but like a week later. And you can see like up here, the time notes, time codes are like, we're at like 20 minutes, you know, because I'm scrambling and that's when I'm looking to, and thinking about stuff and there's so much to react to and change. Here, it's like 2 minutes, 2:10, 3:10, 3:41, and things are like trim, you know, kill Capone, which is something you should do in every story that you hear. And this is almost like creating like a transcript, and you're, this is like good progression. This means that now most of this is just me like writing things down, looking at the time, thinking about how it's pacing out. That means that from the edit before to this, like a lot of good work was done. This is, this is from an edit that I was brought into. When I'm not just scrambling and listening, I write like Thomas Jefferson, it's beautiful. But this is, I came into an edit, this was a story I for another show that I was brought in to be a new listener, and I think I asked at what percentage, and they thought that, they told me that it was like at 60 or 70, and I think it turned out to be very not that, and so as, this is sort of me doing what I was talking about, but then as I realized that, like really just going into like big questions, because I realized that the thing that was going to be helpful with me for this was actually talking about the structure of the piece, what, where it was going, what, et cetera, et cetera. Another thing, this one is very weird. This piece had like 10 different interviewees, something like that, and they all kind of sounded the same. And at a certain point, I just started numbering the acts by voice. So like number four was talking, number four was talking, number four was talking, because it was, that was one of the problems with it. This is like an actual script. So this is also from this heavyweight that's coming up. And I was doing an edit with Jonathan, and I was listening to this thing, and this, it's a really lovely piece that comes up, but there's, especially at the beginning, lots of different, it was all, it's all him standing in front of a building in Brooklyn, but there's moments where he's standing in front of that building at age 15, there's moments where he's standing at that moment of in Brooklyn now, being in Montreal at age 15, being in Montreal at age 14 or 16, being in Montreal now, and it started to get incredibly confusing to me, and I realized that as I was doing like my mad scramble, I was totally getting lost. So I knew that I had to diagram it, but we didn't need to like put it on a whiteboard and diagram the whole thing. I needed to diagram it for myself so that I could get a sense of what the structure was. One. Two, and this is where like Jonathan is in that fourth box. So this piece is really personal to him, and he didn't want me futzing a lot with the language. He'd worked on it a lot. And I knew that if I did this on Google Docs, like I will just, this is knowing yourself. I will be tempted to start rewriting lines and thinking about this. So I printed it out, which let me, and this is sort of me being like, okay, 15, he's in Montreal, 15, he's on his trip, 15, he's in New York, he's an adult, he's in New York, et cetera. But it also just let me leave my edits to like the big things that needed to change and not sort of like the finicky stuff. So those are some ways that I take notes. Yes?
Can you talk about really short pieces, editing really short pieces, like a minute?
Uh-huh. I am not the best person to talk about editing really short pieces, like a minute, although I've done it. But so what's your question about that?
With such a small amount of time, what's the most effective way to make needed changes?
I mean, I think that the... It's, I guess, figuring out, like, what this piece has to do, right? If it's, like, if it is a clarity of information, then clarity of information. Figuring out if, one of the best ways to learn like structure when you're starting out is 30-second promos or minute-long promos, right? That's like a thing that people do. And it's because the structure, you know, you can do like a beginning, a middle, end, or you take a piece of tape and you put the thoughts around it and you create your thing. I don't see why you can't think of minute-long pieces in some ways in the way that you think about longer pieces, which is like basically diagramming out what needs to happen, being very clear. I don't know. I'll think about it, and I will welcome any answers. Yes, and yes, and yes. Okay, so the question is, what tips do you have for people who have to be their own editors and who don't have a team? My first tip is to listen to that Deborah George thing, because she talks a lot about that, and her guidance is to people to become their own editors. The next tip, and I forgot to mention this at the beginning, there's the training.npr.org, I guess, or com, has like actually really helpful, like simple sort of laid out documentation on a lot of things, and their editing stuff is really good. But beyond that, I think making sure that you're listening like an editor. Doing all of those things that I told yourself, being mean to yourself when you need to be mean, like strive to be understanding, to like listen to the thing in as distance away as possible. Scrawl your notes, do all of that stuff, listen actively, but also find people who you trust, explain to them what you're doing, make them read the NPR training stuff. That might be like the most useful use for that, is to make your friends read that stuff so that they can come and listen to it with like a framework for what they need to do. You know, those are some ideas.
Hey, so hey. My question is about second and third and fifth and tenth edits, and whether you have tricks or tips as to, first of all, how not to use the first edit that you saw as a baseline and then just see that there's some, it's improving, but sort of, it's hard to judge whether it's actually reached a level which is good, and also how to avoid kind of frustration about, you know, suggestions and comments not being taken into account, and how to basically, how to see the piece as a new piece each time again.
Okay, so how to work through it and come at it clearly as it evolves, and also how not to be offended by paths not taken. Is that?
Yeah, just to see the fifth edit of this story that you've now been following for a month as the first time that you're seeing it and evaluate it on its own merit without kind of considering everything that had gone on beforehand.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that this is going to be the least satisfying answer of all time, but willing yourself to do that and attacking it in the same way. So, like those, you know, those notes, you know, I was listening actively, putting myself in the same framework for this edit as I was for this one, and I think just so that's helpful. Like, not you set the expectations for what you're expecting out of the edit at the beginning of it, but once you're in there, you should be treating it in the exact same way. But beyond that, it is, and there is an art to this, and I don't have like a formula for it, but knowing when to bring in another person, when to bring in other listeners, to make sure that you're maintaining that perspective, that things aren't lost. In The Last Heavyweight, which I'm really proud of, somewhere along the line, a crucial line of script got lost, and it just left the entire thing, you know, this really central question to the piece unanswered. That we had just become too insular. We totally, all of us missed it. Yeah. Right. So the response was by the like second or third edit, your outside listener can be helpful. By the 10th or 15th, like you're basically be part of the problem. And I think part of that is like that establishing a structure where you do not have 10 or 15 edits, right? Where you are created, I mean, yes, because that will like kill everybody involved. But also because things have to progress, and if they can't progress, they have to die. That's one. Also, like, it is insane what degree, I don't know, there is like a shared strand of DNA among almost all of us who work in here of just total perfectionism. And I have it, and so many people I work with have it, and that is a thing that you have to sort of actively keep in check. I don't know. I mean, I think that if you get to a place that, you know, you've gone through three or four or five edits and you still need more edits, that means that the piece is fundamentally broken, or you're being too finicky. Maybe you're not trusting the producer. You know, you're trying to make the language perfect. In terms of bringing other people into the edit, that can be super problematic. You have to figure out when to do it. And part of that is figuring out who, I think like you asked, who has the, I don't know, maybe you didn't. Like who's running the edit and who has like the, who has stakes in the story. So if you're a senior producer and you're editing a producer and there's a host or an editor who is going to have like important things to say about it, bringing that person in too far along the process is going to be, can be disastrous, because they can come in and just say, this is not the piece that I wanted, or this is not going to work. Bringing them in too early can be a waste of their time. That's figuring out your team, and then, yeah, acting on it. Okay.
Do you have any like specific tips for dealing with like a really big ego? Like any specific things to say or talk to someone that way?
Do I have specific tips about dealing with a very big ego? I think that, I don't know if I have specific tips, only to say that, like the bigger the ego, like kind of the easier they are to predict, and that if you're really, instead of going at it with fear, if you go at this person with strategy, start reading online about how to deal with difficult personalities, because people have the same, people are susceptible to the same things. So like flattery, figuring out, I mean, an important thing is figuring out how to get something that you want done or a suggestion to come out of their mouth so that it feels like their idea, so that they have buy-in. And that part of that is checking your own ego, right? Being an editor like is a lot about, you know, checking your own ego, because sometimes you basically make something and you're never going to get credit for it, and it has to be okay. I mean, you can bitch about it a little bit, but, so I should say that. But I guess my biggest tip is not to go at it through fear, to go at it through complete and utter, total, just hard-boiled strategy. You figure out if they're in a, you know, better mood on Wednesday mornings for some reason, or if you know your edits go better with them after lunch and you start scheduling things there. You know, lots and lots of things, but it's mind games, but it's really just like taking all of your empathy, and instead of applying it in the ways that we think about applying empathy, applying it to somebody who, like, we think doesn't deserve it. I mean, I'll do all the questions, but I don't want to, but I want you to move the microphone around so that I don't skip people. And while you do that, I'll while you find out who's going to ask next. I mean, I'm happy to. Lunch is happening. I'm happy to answer more questions. So whatever. But people were asking about when I use scripts and not use scripts. And so I like to have a script around. I like to listen, not looking at the script. And then when I'm when we're working on the piece, I like to have a script to refer to. When people are doing like tape selects. So if it's like very early in the piece and you've done an interview and you've cut down all your tape, I will listen to it in the exact same way, but I like to have a transcript there so that I can look at it and see sort of what I'm missing and ask sort of what is happening. And then as we go into like finer edits, as the piece is getting to where it needs to be, then like I work with the script in front of me often.
You mentioned this before a little bit, and this might be a whole other session. But what are some of the things that you do to help reporters find their own voice? Like you mentioned, not trying to make everything sound like you.
A lot of it is getting them to tell you the story. Getting them to tell you the story, getting them and by tell you the story, that can mean a lot of different things. It can be just like going through the beats. It can be like talking about sort of like what the core thing is. It can be, so that's like one. Another is, you know, those boxes aside, figuring out when to let them take the lead or when to like tease out from them what they're trying to say. I mean, voice is a lot of different things. It's style, it's like how you write, it's how you look at the world. And so I think there's probably different ways of drawing that out of people from each one of those, but mostly it is seeing what they're doing, and if it's being able to recognize if it's fitting into a format that doesn't like feel like them, or that the way that the piece sounds is not the way that it sounds when they're talking about it. That's like a tip that there's a problem, and then it's just figuring out how to get them to be confident enough to try things out, and that is then, you know, basically giving them the option to try risk, to be risky, because they know that you're going to be supportive, even if it means that in that being supportive, you're, you know, cutting their beautiful, risky pieces of tape out of it.
I'm just curious, it sounds like you guys don't necessarily have a formula for when you bring new people into your edit. It's sort of case by case.
Mm-hmm.
We quite often will have our very first draft have everyone take a look at it. Team. So five folks go for the very first draft. Do you think that's a bad idea? You think you should start with one editor for that first go through?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think it depends on your team and where people are, and also what expectations you're setting, right? Who's everybody in that situation?
So like, you know, everyone from the executive producer down to like our newest producer will sit in and like give notes on the first draft.
Mm-hmm.
So it's five of us.
Right. And a first draft is like an actual draft that's written out with acts and tracks and everything else.
So we actually, we actually do rough mixes as our first draft. Mm-hmm. And this is another thing I was curious to ask you about, is that we don't listen together all in a room. Everyone listens in headphones in their own time, and then we come together and give feedback separately.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of in the spirit of that, like, listen to how you actually consume it. Like, it's,
sure.
You don't tend to listen to audio together.
Yeah. Right. Well, so that's like, I think we do that with mixes, but we don't, our first drafts are never our first mixes. But so, But I mean, I think it can be fine if everybody is collaborating and working on things together. In those cases, I presume like that the story has gone through this process of, you know, like of pitch, of like meetings about structure, storyboarding, diagramming, all of that out, and that you're getting to a first draft that is like solid enough to bring everybody in on. In which case, yeah, absolutely. I would definitely do that. So yeah, I don't know, that seems good to me.
We tend to narrow down so that our final draft is just being edited by one person. But it sounds like you guys will often bring in new people right at the end.
I don't know if right at the end. I think it's more at critical junctures where right at the end is going to only be so helpful, right? But so like at critical junctures where another voice who might have some idea or change to make, there is time for that to be incorporated. But again, I think there isn't a standard way of doing things. And it really, really, really depends on your team. So Reply All, I have not been part of their like editing process, although they've told me about it, but they asked me to listen to a piece that they'd been working on, because they'd been working on it for like a year, and it wasn't like a group editing session or anything. They just wanted like some feedback to see if there was anything that they were missing, and I did, and they gave me access to their script, and I put some notes in there, but I also noticed that I think they were like publishing it. You know, like the night that they were publishing it, it was like 5, 6 p.m., and then it was, you know, 8 p.m., 9 p.m., and you could just sit there and watch like a TV show, like five different people working on this thing at the same time, all editing it together, and getting this thing like sort of over the finish line. And not all of those people were in the same room, but they were collaborating because they had been working with this piece for a long time. They have a shared vision. They have like trust and presume, maybe I'm right or maybe I'm wrong, like that there's also at a certain point like veto power. But that wasn't a final edit. That was like a moving edit that was going on all the way up until basically like the final mix was done. If you can do that, that's, you know, seems like a lot of fun and also crazy making.
I wanted to ask you about those four boxes, and like specifically like the second box of like a disillusioned learner, which I think is like a category that like none of us, like isn't especially attractive, and like I think that none of us would really want to be there. But the way that was laid out, it sort of made it seem like a step in the process. So I wonder if you think that that's like a kind of phase that everybody needs to go through at some point, and I guess this is sort of related to that, is like how to like get through that phase as quickly as possible, or if there's ways to like kind of like avoid the crappier parts of like having the shine wear off and still needing to learn a lot.
So yes, I think that everybody goes through that phase. I think that it is just the process of growth and of learning how to do something that is very, very difficult. I hadn't thought about it until yesterday, but my wife was a producer at This American Life for a long time, and she was an intern before that. And she wrote an essay for some book that I'm sure you can find. That was about a basic. I think it's a book about mentorship, and it was about like the feeling of going from being an intern to being a producer at This American Life, and like how difficult that is, and what she had to change in herself in order to like make sense of that process. And in retrospect, like what she is talking about is going from box one to box two. There are some places and times in your life where you might feel like you're in box two for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. The trick to getting through that is like A, recognizing that it's okay, that you're doing really hard work, figuring out ways of giving your own self like affirmative feedback without just purposely disillusioning yourself, and also not being afraid to like ask for feedback, that, you know, and so that you can create like markers for your own growth, and to go back and listen to stuff that you've done before and like figure out like the progress. But the main thing is really just knowing that this is a thing that everybody goes through. You have to go through it, and it's hard, and you'll get out of it. I haven't watched them in a while, but like the Ira Glass like storytelling YouTube videos. Have you seen those? Like a lot of that is about this process. I mean, he puts it in just in terms of like creativity, but it's about getting to when you're at that point where everything you make feels like it sucks, or you're not, there's something that you're not getting, like powering through it, and different tips for how to do it. What's your wife's name? My wife's name is Diane Cook. she wrote a great book of short stories called Man v. Nature. It's available now. And I'm not sure what the... It was a book that came out maybe last year about like people writing about their mentors. That essay was in.
Thanks. Hey, I can make this quick. So I'm just wondering how you approach your or adapt this editing process when time is not on your side. Say you have a deadline coming up, you'd love to do 5 edits, maybe you can do 1 or 2. How do you approach that?
So there was a line that I had in here that I didn't say. I think when it was, sometimes you just have to fix it, right? In like the making things better, like going through and having that stance versus like I'm just gonna take this over and do it. Sometimes you actually just have to assert yourself, right? But that being said, if you're up against, like the thing hasn't been finished and you're up against the deadline and it's sudden, if you're working on like much shorter timetables, just as a general rule, then it's figuring out a process that works to get you to get the work done in that time, right? So making sure that maybe like that first edits have gotten to a point where they're almost, you know, first mixes, you know, where I think there's probably different ways of establishing a process that works depending on the situation. But it's mostly just if you have to publish every day, then figuring out establishing what needs to happen in edits, before edits, how much time between them and what has to happen between one and the other, in order to for that not to be like a recipe for stress, but actually like a recipe for satisfied work. That's all I got for that. Anybody?
Nice. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.